Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org.
Thank you, everyone, for being here on a beautiful, beautiful summer morning. So the topic of this talk is called Embodying Wisdom Beyond Thoughts and Words. And I always have to give a title sometime before I give a talk, and that doesn't always work out very well, but actually this one is very much about working with our bodies as part of our practice. So hopefully something in here will speak to you. There's a lot of different layers to embodying our practice. I just recently came out of a 10-day retreat in a Tibetan tradition. And one of the liturgical activities that we did involves all these elaborate offerings on the altar. If you think this altar is full, you should see this one. It's got bowls of fruit, bowls of water, many candles, several vases of flowers. It's just stuffed. But in addition to these, for this one particular ceremony, we had to make offerings called tormas, which are actually represent the body of deities. They're made out of roasted barley flour and melted butter and hot water, and you knead them with your hands and shape these funny little lumpy things, paint them red and stick dots of butter all over them. And they're really way different from anything in the Zen tradition, for sure. But these tormas represent the body of the deity, and in the course of the ceremony, people will eat pieces of the tormas. They'll be sliced and pieces will be handed out. I think it's kind of related to communion, this idea that the body of the deity and my body are one, and we can represent this by eating this dense barley stuff. So that was a lot of fun to make the tormas, working with the lamas and getting the transmission of their secrets that they had for how to make them stick together and actually shape them. And that's a kind of embodiment. It's acknowledging that this body that we're in has something to do with the body of the deity. And so starting with that, I would say the first kind of way that we look at our bodies in terms of wisdom is that we speak of wisdom as being beyond conceptuality, that concepts about wisdom are just, we say, the finger pointing at the moon. That's what we say in Zen. And not the moon itself. Of course, what that does is it has us looking way out in the sky and pointing at something we can't touch. We need these concepts to start with, and there's a variety of methods that we have to use to transcend those initial concepts that we start working with. So what we're doing in our practice is kind of bringing the moon home, and for us, our home is our body. What we're doing is recognizing that the moon is not out there. It's in us, in that we are not separate from it. This wisdom that the moon represents is within us already. It's not like we have to go out and find it and grab it and bring it, so much as we are uncovering the innate wisdom within us. We already embody wisdom, so we don't have to do anything extra to make that happen. But we do have to uncover it. We've got to be able to recognize it when it's there. And much of the time, I think we can believe that that's true, but not necessarily have confidence that it's true for us. Maybe for some folks that's true, but for me, I there's got to be something more, a little kind of supplemental stuff I can do to make sure it's really there. So for most of us, it's pretty theoretical, this moving beyond conceptuality, getting rid of our ideas about it, the things, our hang-ups, the things that get in the way of actually being able to recognize, oh yeah, this is who I am, too. And the most basic way that we approach that, of course, in the Zen tradition is through meditation. And not only does meditation help us let go and kind of divest ourselves of the stuff that's making it impossible for us to see that inner wisdom, but the meditation posture itself is the embodiment of wisdom. When we sit in the posture of Zazen, whether it's in a chair or on a cushion, no matter how perfect or imperfect that posture might be, when our intention is to do Zazen, we take a posture and begin to follow our breath, we are manifesting wisdom at that moment. We're manifesting wisdom at that moment, even though we tend to think of it as a means to the end of having wisdom. For me, anyway, it takes a lot of patience to be able to relax and rest in the breath, to allow the body to settle down, to release my grip on my stories and thoughts about things. It takes work to get to that point. And also, we feel like we should be doing something more. I mean, a lot of the time, it doesn't feel like we're doing much of anything when we're following our breath, and our minds really are always trying to kind of double up on that. It's like, well, as long as I'm just sitting here, why don't I work on this problem? And so there we go, off again onto our thoughts or telling ourselves a story about something. But following the breath and just being able to relax into that is really the key to make this happen. But just following the breath is kind of boring, isn't it? We always want to entertain ourselves in some way. There's a great Zen story about this boredom. I just love it. A young monk complains to his teacher about following the breath being boring. The teacher says, no, you gotta keep doing it. Oh, I want something more. Can't we add something to the meditation? Isn't there some other thing I can be doing during meditation than just following the breath? And he said, it's just too boring. I can't keep my mind on it. So the next time the student came into the teacher was ready for him. He had a big basin of water in the Doksan room when the student came in, and he asked the student again. He said, are you still feeling bored following your breath? Yep, yep. And he said, oh, okay, let's try something. And he pushed his head into the bucket of water. And of course the student is gasping and spitting, and when he finally comes up, you know, gasping for air, the teacher said, now do you think breathing is boring? So sometime, and of course no teacher would do that now. You get in a lot of trouble for that kind of physicality. But the point is a really key one to remember, and hopefully that this teacher was able to get across to the student, is the breath has so much to teach us. If we follow the breath, we learn so much about what's going on in our body and how we relate to it. This is really key information to have, because another aspect of embodying wisdom is through physical activity, physicality itself, and Zen really excels in providing opportunities for us to do this through work, practice, through the arts, all of these things, the rituals that we do. The essence of Zen practice is really engaging fully with the world around us in every possible way. And it's important, for example, not to rely on just one or two senses. We tend to do 90% of our exploration through either our eyesight or our hearing. And then what happens when we take in information through our eyes or our ears is we almost immediately have an opinion about it. It's like, oh, that's this or that. Here's what's going on there. I figured that out. And then we stop bringing in information because we've made up our mind what's going on. We don't need any more information to fill in the blanks. We can create it from there. So one of the most important pieces of our practice is to really allow ourselves to use all of our senses to explore what's coming into us. And we chant in the Heart Sutra, no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. It's a good list. Keep it in mind. Am I using all of these different sense gates to explore what's going on? Yamakawa Roshi, who is the abbot of Shogenji Monastery in Japan, comes from time to time to Daibosatsu Zendo in New York to teach. And I remember him telling a story when I was training there of a lay student he knew who was blind, who drew on all of his other senses to track what was going on around him. He would sit on a bench near a certain tree in a park every day. And he told Roshi that he could feel the energy in that tree change when children entered the park, because he could hear the children coming by their voices. And he said the tree literally would radiate warmth towards the children. It was just connecting with the children in some way. He didn't know what way, but he could definitely feel the warmth coming from the tree. We don't notice much of what's going on around us. It took him being blind to tune in that way to other things that were going on around him. And it's a very subtle sort of thing, but we can do that too. We don't have to be blind to do that. If we really pay attention and make a point to use these other senses, and try to stay with that direct perception as long as we can before we immediately begin labeling and judging, assessing what the situation is, but just allow as much information in as possible. It's very interesting how what we assess may change with bringing in more information. When we're able to rest in the sensations themselves, these perceptions themselves, our experience can be one of appreciation rather than like or dislike, rather than pleasant or unpleasant. We so quickly decide which pile it goes in. I like this, I don't like this. But if we can stay with those perceptions, It relieves us of having to have an opinion about these things. There's a koan that I love that speaks to this exactly, the case 43 of the Blue Cliff Record. It goes, a monk said to Tozan, his teacher, cold and heat descend upon us. How can we avoid them? Tozan said, why don't you go where there is no cold or heat? The monk liked that idea. He said, where is the place where there is no cold or heat? Tozan said, when it is cold, let it be so cold that it kills you. When it is hot, let it be so hot that it kills you. Now, sometimes people think this koan is asking us to stretch ourselves to the limit, to sit zazen in extraordinary conditions. But you remember from the story of the Buddha, he decided that that type of austerity wasn't really as conducive to practice as it might be. And that's not really how I see this. The point here is not to resist or avoid conditions we find unpleasant, boring, or uncomfortable, but to open ourselves directly to that experience without inserting our opinion or characterization between the experience and ourselves. It's not literally, obviously, asking us to kill ourselves, but to cut off the egotistical additions getting in the way of fully experiencing hot or cold. Let it be so cold that it kills your ego. Let it be so hot that it kills your ego, your attachment to what you want it to be. You want it to be pleasant. It's beautiful right now, right? This is just right to temperature, unless you've got a lot of layers on like this. But that's okay. You know, you can really enjoy that little bit of breeze that comes in. You really appreciate the breeze when you're a little hot. You can really appreciate the warmth of somebody standing next to you when you're really cold. It brings up our appreciation when we let ourselves directly experience something. For me, cancer has been a terrific reminder of this body. First of all, not to take it for granted, but also not to hold back from experiencing the full range of what one experiences going through a disease like this. And that's all about how we experience the world around us. The flip side of this is how we express ourselves in the world through our activity, our work practice, samu, artistic expression, both of which are really key to Zen practice. And so much has been said and written about these topics that I don't really want to say much about it today, except to address one thing I often hear people say, which is, oh, I get how to be mindful when you're doing something like cooking or you're doing something like sweeping the floor. That's easy. I can do that. But what about when you have an activity that involves a meeting with people, particularly people who aren't Zen practitioners, right? They don't have the same way of looking at things, perhaps. Or if you have to plan ahead. Planning doesn't seem to be something that one can do in this mindful, present mind sort of way. And I really disagree with that. In Dogen's instructions to the Tenzo, the cook, he talks at some length about the planning and preparation that's part of the Tenzo's work. I mean, you have to know how much rice to soak before you cook it. You have to know who's sick and not eating very much, how many young monks you have that are going to eat a lot. You've got to be able to figure this out pretty well, because if you've got 200 and some people in your monastery, you can go astray pretty quick and waste food or have some very hungry people. So, you know, Dogen says, do not be absent-minded in your activities, nor so absorbed in one aspect of a matter that you fail to see the other aspects. He's talking about having that peripheral vision around our focus on one particular thing. Much of the Tenzo's efforts must go into planning meals in terms of timing and quantity, and our intellect is fully engaged in that, but our heart is open at that time to the many ramifications of every action we take, going beyond the simple intellectual assessment. There's a wonderful commentary by Kosho Uchiyama on this text. It's called How to Cook Your Life, and he says, to express it in simpler terms, I am speaking of a present moment which includes direction, wherein you prepare tomorrow's gruel tonight. It is not a present which relies on tomorrow's happiness. So we're not leaning into some future reward for our actions, in other words, when we plan. When we're planning, we're just planning. It requires a directionality, no question about that. You can't guarantee the future, though. So you don't want to be dependent on a particular result. And that's the way we operate in the present and still plan. Dogen says, speaking to this, that Tenzo tries to build great temples from ordinary greens, which expounds the Buddha Dharma through the most trivial activity. Handle even a leaf, single leaf of a green in such a way that it manifests the body of the Buddha. This in turn allows the Buddha to become manifest through the leaf. Everything we encounter is part of our living body. Most especially, we have to move beyond seeing any activity as less than any other activity. Any activity we do can fulfill this embodying wisdom. So from this, we're able to see ourselves as integral to that activity, not kind of, well, I'll get this done so I can move on to something more important. If we can really be fully with that activity, not separate from it, not hustling through to get to something more interesting or important to do, then we really become one with it. A fourth way that we embody wisdom is by learning how to recognize how emotional activity registers in our body. This is really a key point. Oftentimes we can catch a strong emotion as it arises by noting the sensations in the body, a faster heart rate, a tightened jaw, make choices about how to act on that moment before we get completely hijacked by that emotion, often running towards a less skillful response. An interesting observation I've found is that often our strongest reactions to the actions of others are to things we don't want to be reminded of in ourselves. I've said this before, but means that others can be an excellent mirror for us for the habits we can't see as well when we're trying to examine ourselves. If we note our own negative reactions to others' actions, it's like, oh, I do that. Don't really like that. It's not very nice, is it? We don't want to know that about ourselves. But when we see it in other people, it's much easier to recognize. It's all useful information if we pay attention and register it in our body. So if we work with our bodies in all these ways in our practice, we find that even the most complex in-your-head types of activities and interactions can be paths to wisdom beyond words and thoughts. So even a difficult conversation can be wisdom beyond words and thoughts. That nothing in our daily lives need be exempt, and that we can delight in embodying wisdom in this way.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.